up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule, American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass, working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell.
Many of us can look back on our high school days as a kind of a blur of early morning wake-ups that launched us into our day, with those first few hours as our least favorite and least productive of the whole day. Now there's research to affirm what many might have suspected, that adolescents in particular are just not morning people. Dr. Jim Shan, executive director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center, has looked at the research and wonders why it hasn't been applied here. He's with us in our studio. Hi, Jim. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Anything that allows us to lead off with a Chuck Berry song is...
Yeah, that was good enough. Now, can I go now?
No.
Okay.
We have to build on that now.
Okay.
But, you know, the whole idea of how your brain works at certain hours of the day is getting explored in greater detail.
That's right. You've got a young person going through a growth spurt who needs 8 hours of sleep. So regardless of your biorhythms and everything else,
right,
if you're not getting enough sleep, you're not really going to be as productive as you could anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Secondly, what you alluded to is the adolescent mind is a nocturnal mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are awake at midnight, raring mm-hmm. to go, right?
Yeah.
But in the early morning, they are not. And this, there seems to be some evidence this is not just American kids. This is like a universal aspect of adolescent development. Right?
This is just human development, period.
That's exactly right. Now, on top of that, they get to school, 8 o'clock, it's time for Algebra 3, right? All the hard stuff is packed in early, right?
Yeah.
And these kids are just like groggy as can be. And then when you add other routine aspects of our industrial factory-like schools.
Right.
Every classroom's the same. Every class is 42 minutes. The little chairs are in little rows. They're not in circles to engage each other, right? You've got the trifecta or whatever of boredom, sleepiness.
Routine.
Routine. These are things that are not created for optimum learning by those students,
yeah.
right? And then when you add our traffic problems as well, right?
Yeah.
Now, we do know that some schools in Hawaii have begun to inch along in that way. Kaimuki High has done that, right? They moved their start time back an hour, right, from 8 o'clock to about 9 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
They do not have to rely on a DOE bus system. So anybody gets their... Either their parents drop them off, or they walk, or they take the city buses.
Because it's in a neighborhood, you mean?
That's right, because in an urban area,
the physical layout of...
That's right. Yeah. And the other thing is that we insist that every day be the same. You know, some people are intimidated by the notion of, oh, what a logistical nightmare to shift our entire school every day later. Why don't you just try Wednesday, you know?
Yeah.
Wednesday is a short day anyway, you know?
Uh-huh.
1:30, get out of here. We seem to be bound up in this notion that any incremental change based on research has to be comprehensive. And this is a little bit of the tyranny of the comprehensive, I think.
Uh-huh.
We need to encourage more experimentation. We need to encourage and give schools some resources. Well, now that we're doing this, let's see if we can determine, are the students brighter? Are the teachers reporting they're more alert? They're learning better? Are they still sleeping at their desks, you know, at 9:30? There's a lot of ways that we can be more intentional and directional in looking at serious research that relates to learning. We're so into reducing the gaps on big tests.
Yeah.
But when it comes to how we structure our school and how we deal with time, sometimes we're a little asleep ourselves.
Well, Jim, you hit on something which is I've observed more than once in the educational community, which is the results of a study are released, and then they get studied.
That's right.
right? But wait a minute, didn't it just get studied? Do we then proceed from this finding? Or, you know, why do you study a finding? It's a finding. That's why they call it that, right?
Yeah. We'll wait a few years and give me $1 million, and we'll study it to update the last study, right? Uh-huh. Which we did nothing about, right?
Frequently, which lead to a fairly intuitive conclusion that where you know, at the end of all this, you say, hey, I could have told you that.
That's right. There's a kind of duh, you know, moment there that every parent knows, right?
Yeah.
And I think that one of the aspects of it is that if a school has the authority and the power at the school level and the encouragement to experiment, more of them will. Mm-hmm. But right now we don't have a system where we really have decentralized decision making, which is true in the charter schools but not true in our DOE schools that much.
Yeah.
The fact that Kaimuki and one or two others have begun doing it anyway shows there's maybe a little more cultural barrier and institutional thought barrier than real barriers to this kind of change. But if we're serious about these young people emerging as future citizens and members of our workforce and whatnot, who have not just slept through some of the more consequential classes.
Yeah.
If we're serious about that, we have to be serious about this kind of research. This is biology. This is science.
What you're talking about on one level is a kind of institutional flexibility. And as you well know, institutions, as they grow, tend to move away from flexibility because they develop an institutional culture, and then within that culture, thou shalt obey. Yeah.
That's right. And big systems and big schools, and by the way, on average, we have some of the largest schools by enrollment in the nation, right? When you've got 3,000 students on campus, right, the logistical mandates of just getting through the day and all the schedules and all that, this takes over the prerequisites, the priorities of good learning environments, right? When you have smaller schools, smaller learning communities, and by the way, Kaimuki is interesting because they have had their enrollment shrink. So they've actually had a lot of not only physical but educational space to experiment. Mm-hmm. They have several academies broken down their school into subcategories, right? So this smaller learning community realm gives you the opportunity to experiment.
They're going small and benefiting from it, presumably.
Small is beautiful. You have Schumacher.
Is that an educational principle?
Oh, well, that was a famous book in the 60s or so, Small is Beautiful, and it's part of that trend of grassroots movements.
What would it take to, you know, bring about the kind of changes you're talking about?
Well, I think the Board of Education, through its various plans and whatnot, has to be much more intentional and focused. We want you to take risks in these areas, right? I think there may be some discussion that would have to happen in collective bargaining to make sure that, you know, that wasn't getting in the way with number of classes taught and everything like that. But I also think real empowerment by the school councils in our DOE, somewhat similar to what the charters have, gives people the opportunity. It won't guarantee it, but the opportunity to say, yeah, let's try this. And if the board and the new superintendent do not slap their hand for failing, right, you have to have permission to fail in order to learn.
We'll be talking to Beth Ann will be talking to the superintendent of schools tomorrow, so we'll see if this gets
Ask
brought
her
up.
About that.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Jim Shawn has been a Peace Corps teacher, is a 12-year state legislator, and is currently executive director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, focusing on environmental cleanup in West Hawaii. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we remembered an early 70s Cold War spy story that rivals anything John Le Carré could have dreamed up. It's about a very unusual ship that anchored in Hawaii waters, under the cover story that it was to be used for an underwater mining operation. It was mining, so the story went, for manganese nodules. No one knew exactly what those were, but the cover story held, but some details of the ship's real mission have only emerged in recent years. To make a long story short, the Howard Hughes-designed vessel was in fact a spy ship, and in 1974 it was able to steal a nuclear submarine from a depth of 3 miles in the Pacific waters, 1,500 miles northwest of Hawaii, a technological feat that has been compared to the moon landing. Today we're asking if you remember the name of this one-of-a-kind ship. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Ed Ebisui. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's an ambitious environmental restoration project that could become a model for others like it. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration will award $646,000 to the Kohala Center on Hawaii Island to help maintain and restore the Kauai High watershed within the West Hawaii Habitat Focus Area. Beth Ann Kosovich spoke to the Kohala Center's Chief Operating Officer, Annalisa Okoye, about what the project can mean.
You've just been the recipient, or will very soon be the recipient, of an award of over $600,000, which has been characterized as being given for environmental restoration and maintenance. What programs will actually benefit from the money that you're receiving from the Senate Appropriations Committee?
The Kohala Center is a community-based nonprofit for research, education, and conservation. And what we do is we take research and ancestral knowledge and turn it into action so that communities in Hawaii and beyond can benefit ecologically, economically, socially, and culturally. We have three main areas of interest, which include food self-reliance, energy self-reliance, and ecosystem health. And under our ecosystem health programs, we run the Kohala Watershed Partnership Program. And so that is the core program that will be implementing the project that's been funded by this NOAA grant that we've received.
In the Kauai High Watershed, where exactly does that start, and what exactly will the money do to be able to continue the work?
Sure. So this is the Kauai High 1 watershed, which borders the Pelikane Bay watershed, and it encompasses 8,500 acres. This is in West Hawaii in Kohala, and this is part of what's been designated a NOAA West Hawaii Habitat Blueprint Focus Area. And NOAA has designated this area because of various threats. Main threats right now are sedimentation of the coral reef from erosion and runoff from that watershed. And so what's happened is that the presence of feral ungulates, primarily goats, as well as some overgrazing at times by cattle and the presence of non-native invasive plant species has created an environment on that watershed where the soil has been destabilized because there's not enough vegetation there and not enough of the right native vegetation there to stabilize the soil. And so when you look at the gradient of the land and the fact that you know, over the past few years, we've been experiencing these more intense storm events. When that happens, you have a significant amount of sediment that runs off of Kohala Mountain through that watershed and enters the ocean, and it threatens the coral reef. And as a consequence, all of the marine life that relies on that coral reef to survive.
Right, from the mountains to the sea. As mm-hmm. you look, though, at a solution for some of that, you know, fencing seems as if that's not going to help water running off.
Right. So this project has a number of deliverables that have been shown in our experience to effectively address erosion and sedimentation and lead to improved coral reef health over time. So we've actually implemented all of the deliverables I'm about to go through now during our Pelicane Bay watershed project that ran several years ago and had been studied by the University of Hawaii and shown that these watershed remediation activities do in fact help contribute to coral reef stabilization. So this project, we're going to be enclosing the 8,500-acre watershed in 12 miles of fence.
Will you also be putting in then more trees and shrubs that will be holding down that more loose land and soil, or what do you have in mind for it?
Yeah, yep. So after the fence is complete, we're going to be removing the feral ungulates from the unit, and those goats are one of the primary pressures on vegetation.
And what will you do with those goats?
The project is a 3-year project. We're going to spend the first 2 years building the fence, and during that 2-year period, we're going to be reaching out to our community partners and the community in general to try to find productive uses of these goats. And so some of the ideas on the table are partnering with the local community. This at the base of this watershed is the Honokoa DHHL Kailapa community, and so we'll be partnering with that community to see if they have ideas for productive uses of these goats. There's a local pet food company that has shown interest in utilizing these goats, and there's also a mobile slaughter unit on island, and so we'll be reaching out to them.
So in some ways it sounds as if these goats are going to wind up as food, maybe food for pets, maybe food for other folks, but that they're going to be slaughtered.
Oh, yes, yeah. We don't have a place, another place on island for the goats to go. So yeah. So our hope is to be able to find a productive use for them. And that's a complex process. So it'll take quite a bit of effort to coordinate all of that.
Are you getting any people pushing back to the idea of having roughly 1,000 goats that are going to be, you know, as you put it, used productively?
Not that I know of. You know, I don't know how many people are really aware of the pressures that these goats place on our natural ecosystem. And so, you know, part of our mission as an organization is to educate the public and do outreach so that people can kind of understand how dynamic our ecosystem is and how one thing affects the other. So, you know, we're happy to take questions and reach out to folks and explain, you know, why we're doing this work and why NOAA is supportive of these remediation efforts.
I ask you because every time we have an issue like this that comes up and the idea of having to remove an ungulate, and that usually will mean destruction of that ungulate population, we get a lot of calls from people who are upset about that. And I'm just curious because you haven't seemingly gotten a lot of those.
You know, this program's been running for quite some time. And so it's possible in the past that we have. And this is a very new project that's starting up right now. So, you know, we're prepared to have conversations and a dialogue as much as we possibly can.
So after they're gone and you replace them with native trees and shrubs, what about any sort of, you know, capture dams so that you don't have runoff that may still be happening given the fact that these trees and shrubs, they're going to need some time to develop and to, you know, put down their roots and hold the soil?
Exactly. So we will be constructing 20 sediment check dams, which are a land-based solution to help collect sediment in the event of a storm event. And so, you know, that is going to be sort of an initial measure to address runoff as the landscape returns and is able to stabilize the soil through vegetation.
Annalisa, what kind of time frame are you looking at to be able to look at it and nod and say, okay, this is done. We've now made sure that we don't have the runoff and we've been able to protect this watershed.
Well, this project is a 3-year project, and that's the anticipated timeline for how long it's going to take for us to complete our specific deliverables. But, you know, they're going to be long-term impacts of this project. And so over time, you know, for many years into the future, we hope to be able to, you know, secure enough funding to maintain the fence, to continue supporting revegetation efforts. And, you know, over time, we should see improvements in coral reef health. Hopefully, you know, part of why NOAA supported this project is because of the increased marine habitat that can support endangered species like the Hawaiian monk seal and green sea turtle. So, 3 years for the specific project, but we expect the impacts to be quite, you know, some long-term impacts.
Along with some hope that you're not going to get any more invasives that begin to undo a lot of what you're trying to accomplish now.
Absolutely.
Well, we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for your interest in this project. We really appreciate it.
And Elisa Okoye is the Kohala Center's Chief Operating Officer. The center is an independent community-based center for research, conservation, and education with 3 main areas of interest: food self-reliance, energy self-reliance, and ecosystem health.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
A $200 million estate intended for the benefit of the Hawaiian people is the subject of an ugly legal battle, complete with allegations of elder abuse. Civil Beat reporter Nick Gruby has today's reality check. Hi, Nick. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
The subject at hand is the estate of Princess Abigail Kauananakoa, who is not apparently able to speak for herself. She had a stroke a few months ago. Is that right?
Yeah, she had a stroke on June 18th, and after that, her former attorney now, James Wright, took control of her trust, which includes over $200 million worth of assets. Mm-hmm. And in court records, he had said, or Wright's attorney had said that Ms. Kauananakoa was, quote, unable to meet essential requirements of physical health, safety, self-care, or financial matters. Mm-hmm. And since then, that has been an issue of contention.
Competence as it's legally defined, right?
Exactly, yes.
Contention between who and whom?
Well, James Wright, again, the former attorney,
right,
took over the trust, as he says was required in legal documents. But now the Princess Abigail Kauananakoa, as she's often referred to, her and her longtime partner, Veronica Gale Worth, are saying that he's done that inappropriately. And yes, Ms. Kauananakoa has her faculties and is able to take care of her own financial matters. So now they are expected to fight over that in the coming weeks.
The eventual end point of this money is the benefit of the Hawaiian people. I mean, that's was the intention of the trust in the first place. Is that right?
Right. Well, there's a lot at stake here. So the trust, again, it's a large trust, and it's estimated to be worth about $200 to $215 million, mm-hmm. Which includes stock from James Campbell Company, some property, as well as some stakes in racehorses and facilities for those racehorses. Now, the trust, when it's split up, will go. There are a handful of beneficiaries that will get a cut of the money, but one of the largest beneficiaries is supposed to be the Abigail Kauananakoa Foundation, which is a nonprofit that is set up with the specific purpose of helping out Native Hawaiians and preserving Native Hawaiian culture and heritage. And so that's what's really at stake here is is that foundation and the future, of course, of Native Hawaiians here in the state of Hawaii.
And is that why the Attorney General's office is getting into the fray here?
That's exactly right. The Attorney General's office has a legal obligation to step in when it comes to charities. And right now, nobody's representing that charity per se. And so they are taking that on, just like they did 20 years ago with the Bishop Estate scandal.
Right.
They stepped in and helped to sort of sort that out.
Well, this has all the earmarks of a story that hasn't entirely run its course yet, Nick. So we'll want to keep track with you about this as it develops.
Exactly. Stay tuned.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nick Gruby. Oahu's abandoned vehicle problem has been widely reported for years and has gotten measurably worse as junkyards either go out of business or determine that disposing of abandoned vehicles is just not profitable. Many of those vehicles come from the military, and the Army's Department of Morale, Welfare, and Recreation has stepped up with a plan that allows soldiers to drop off vehicles they do not wish to keep or sell, which they then inspect, fix up, and sell to incoming soldiers. Beth Ann Kozlovich talked it over with Dennis Duck, Deputy Director of U.S. Army Garrison's Hawaii's Department of Family, Morale, Welfare, and Recreation.
We were asked by our garrison commander, Colonel Stephen Dawson, to see if there was any way that MWR could contribute to alleviating the problem of abandoned vehicles around the base and around the city and the county. So we took a look at what other services were doing. We took a look at what MWR has done in the past, and we came up with this turn-in program.
So how does this work when you have someone who says to you, I have to leave really quickly, here are the keys? Do they get some sort of tax benefit for that?
Their taxes will be up to them as they record the sale of their vehicle at zero, which would help them. But generally, they're going to call our auto skill shop on Schofield Barracks. They will drive the vehicle down there with their appointment, and we will take care of all of the paperwork they need to transfer the title and clear them for departure.
What kind of cars are you seeing?
The types of cars, it's going to vary. I mean, it's going to be whatever they own that they can't sell on their own or that they don't have time to dispose of properly. That's the advantage that we're offering them, is to just bring us the car, bring us the keys, bring us the title. We'll get you all the paperwork. We'll get you cleared and get you out of here.
But in terms of, you know, the kinds of cars, are we talking about, you know, trucks or cute little sports cars or things that might be very saleable, but they just don't have time to do it, so that this might be a good deal for somebody else who's coming to buy one of those cars potentially?
That's exactly the benefit of the program. We're looking at soldiers who are really lost on time. The vehicle needs to be in good shape when they turn it into us, so it needs to have a clear title. It needs to be running, and then our folks will assess it there and put it up online for auction. So the benefit to the service member is I don't have to worry about the time it takes me to sell this. I don't have to worry about clearing all my paperwork, all that kind of fun stuff. We take care of that for them. On the other side of the coin, the person who's coming onto the island, who's looking for a vehicle, will have an opportunity to bid and get a cheap vehicle for his purposes while he's here. So we can turn these cars, we can recycle them, if you will, instead of abandoning them on the side of the road.
When you say get a cheap vehicle, how cheap? We are talking about a Blue Book value, under Blue Book value, and if so, how much?
MWR will assign a minimum bid on each vehicle based on what costs we may have put into it and the cost for us to run this program. But other than that, it's really going to be up to the bidders. I can see vehicles going for well under $1,000 in most cases.
Would this ever be open to a non-soldier?
Not yet. Initially, this is going to be open to MWR authorized patrons only, so ID card holders. So it can be all services, not just soldiers. Their family members, contractors, DOD civilians, any current authorized MWR user at this point.
But you clearly are entertaining the idea that it might be open to others in case they need vehicles and might want to get them more cheaply, and that might increase your business.
It could be, but the end result of this is not a business opportunity for MWR. It's really trying to provide a service and trying to reduce the number of abandoned vehicles that are out there. So the services that we provide are geared towards soldiers and the DOD family here. So we'll start there and see what happens.
As you're just starting it this week, how will you measure its success?
By the number of vehicles that are being turned in as opposed to being abandoned. We imagine that this is probably going to start off pretty slow until people get comfortable and get more information on it. U.S. Army Garrison Hawaii has been aware of this problem for abandoned vehicles on Oahu and has been looking at trying to find a way to reduce these number of vehicles for some time. And they've got communication plans in place now to remind soldiers about their responsibilities, to let soldiers know what they can do with their vehicles, what their options are, and their responsibilities to take care of it in a legal manner. So we hope that it'll start slow but build. And as we get our systems in place and our auction online working and making sure all the kinks are worked out of the program, then we can look at expanding into maybe taking care of some of the vehicles that are already abandoned and putting those online as well.
So how soon do you expect that we might see some data about the cars that are being turned in relative to the ones that you've seen abandoned?
I think it's probably going to be 90 days before this thing is mature enough to actually see if it's having an impact.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing it then. Thank you so much for the time today.
You bet. I appreciate it.
Dennis Duck is the Deputy Director of the U.S. Army Garrison Hawaii's Department of Family, Morale, Welfare, and Recreation. As the voyaging canoes Hokulea and Hikianalia set out today from the Marine Education Training Center at Sand Island to begin their Mahalo Hawaii sail in the wake of the spectacular success of their three-year worldwide Malama Honua voyage, HPR News reporter Ku'uwei Hiraishi has looked behind the scenes at the huge logistical challenge the Polynesian Voyaging Society faced in making it happen. We talked with her about the story she's been working on for our news department and what she learned reporting it.
In terms of raising the funds necessary mm-hmm. to do the voyage, I think a lot of it was just a constant, they had to keep on raising funds. They always had to look for opportunities to get someone to help them out with it.
On a scale that the Polynesian Voyaging Society had not done before, right?
Exactly. So for the last more than 40 years, they were established. The Polynesian Voyaging Society was established in 1973. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, it was always volunteer help that got them going.
Right.
And I think for the most part, it was a staff of like two and a half up and down over the years. So when they took this on, it was like a $10 million a year budget uh-huh. that they really had to ramp up operations and they made it happen, which was the surprising thing.
You know, we you think of the recent voyage, and it was reported as a cultural event, as a international, you know, communications event. This is more of a behind the scenes look at what it took to make it happen, right?
Exactly. And I was mentioning earlier that if Nainoa was sort of Nainoa Thompson, the visionary of this voyage, Clyde Namu'o, the CEO of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, was really that hamster on the wheel, making sure everything's getting done in the background.
Uh-huh.
So we were able to sort of look at the numbers that came in and what it cost. And throughout the entire 3 years, it was a $30 million expense, a price tag on this worldwide voyage.
What were some of the things that had to be paid for that we might not have thought
right,
about?
Right. So you're talking about crew changes. So airfare, lodging, food, also canoe maintenance and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And each crew change, this was an interesting number, each crew change that happened throughout the worldwide voyage cost about $300,000 to $400,000 just for one change.
Flying people to,
exactly.
Where did they have to?
Flying them in, flying them out, lodging them before they get on the canoe, and then also feeding them, of course, and things like that.
Yeah. Where did they make some of these crew changes?
Crew changes, they had 29 throughout the entire worldwide voyage, but it was like the big production we saw in New York.
Uh-huh.
So flying everybody from Hawaii to New York and back. We were there watching it, I think everyone following the worldwide voyage. We saw what was happening, but we didn't realize that it would cost something like that. And they would need to get all of these donations in from very generous donors.
How did they go about soliciting those donations?
So some of it was actually done by the board members going out and asking folks for in-kind donations. So Hawaiian Airlines did a lot of the airfare donations. They also got Starwood Hotels to put up some of the crew members.
Uh-huh.
So 20 of the $30 million was donated in in-kind services. But another interesting thing that I found out was $10 million was donated in cash. So these are online donations that, say, for instance, when they did go to New York, the folks that were there, Hawaiians that had moved there, or people from Hawaii that had moved there a long
yeah.
time ago, got that real sense of sort of pride. And that translated into them going online and making that donation.
Yeah.
So there was, I think, a 230% increase in that second year of the voyage in online donation and online giving.
You know, people in Hawaii have celebrated the growth of pride, the increase of pride that the Hokulea has brought about in, over the last, you know, 50 years now.
Yeah.
But this is something, the recent voyage made it more international, don't you think?
It did. It really raised the profile, not only on voyaging itself or on Hawaii, but on the Polynesian Voyaging Society and their message of Mala Mahonua. And I think that was an interesting part of the donation and the solicitation of donations was they needed to make sure that these corporate donors were going to be in line with the sustainable message of Mala Mahonua.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very careful to only accept donors or donations that were in line with that message. And surprisingly, I had to ask him this, you know, because we deal with this here at HPR as well. We want to make sure that the donors and the money that's funding what we're doing is congruent with our message. And he said, Clyde Namu'u had said that they had no problem in turning away any donations. A lot of the donors and the organizations that wanted to contribute to this and finance this were very much in line with the Mala Mahonua message.
You know, what this speaks to, Kuavehi, is the whole, any organization that, as you might call, values-based has
right.
to, you know, has to sort of follow a similar path, yeah?
Exactly, and I think that from that, these organizations that did donate to the voyage are also very, very cognizant of, okay, now we really are, you know, attached to this message and attached to this voyage. So we need to make sure that our practices continue to honor that.
You know, we're seeing just with the recent national controversy that the corporations want to be identified with a certain set of values, right?
Exactly. And I don't know if you remember that the Coca-Cola fence that went up and there was a big controversy here locally with a conservation project that got a lot of flack for taking money from an organization like Coca-Cola. And I think folks are very much aware on both ends of how it reflects upon either the donor or the person receiving the money.
Well, in your story, Kove, you not only looked at how much was raised and how it was deployed, but just sort of how the whole, you know, asking the question, who pays for this, is sort of a key reporter's function.
Exactly. I think the transparency of finding out where that money is coming from was motivation for this because it is a values-based sort of, you know, approach to figuring out how the Polynesian Voyaging Society could get this done and get this done right.
Kuvei Hiraishi is HPR's General Assignment Reporter. Her story about the finances behind the Malama Honua voyage airs today and can be heard during All Things Considered. You can also listen to it back online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Kanila, Danny Kalekini.
And I'm Nicholas Kalekini.
And you're listening to The Conversation on Members-Supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, the late Howard Hughes is best remembered as an eccentric billionaire, but he also was an innovative designer of ships and aircraft. And a ship of his design that once operated in Hawaiian waters was certainly one of a kind. Its ostensible role was as an underwater mining ship, scouring the Pacific for manganese nodules. Its real task was the recovery of a Soviet submarine that had sunk in waters 3 miles deep, 1,500 miles northwest of Hawaii. Soviet vessels kept a close eye on the so-called underwater mining operation, but bought the cover story and stood by watching, clueless, as the ship raised remnants of the sub K-129 from the ocean floor. The effort was called Project Azorian, and the CIA, in a report declassified in 2010, said, quote, "Azorian ranks in the forefront of imaginative and bold operations undertaken in the long history of intelligence collection." The ship at the heart of the operation was Howard Hughes's Glomar Explorer. And this was a pretty popular quiz. We got a number of calls, but the first to call and get it right was Dennis Inouye of Kaneohe. And if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's a growing trend in music. Artists who are well-versed in traditional instruments and the styles they represent are stepping beyond the borders of genre and geography and finding new combinations of instruments, sounds, melodies, rhythms, new avenues of expression. Island Breeze is a trio that combines slack-key guitar, taiko drums, and shakuhachi, the Japanese bamboo flute. Riley Lee, who has made the shakuhachi his life's work, is with us to tell us how the merger of sound and styles is working. Hi, Riley. Thanks for coming in.
Hello, Chris, or as they would say where I come from, good day, mate.
Yes, I guess they would, wouldn't they? Because you're an Australia transplant now.
Yes.
But you studied shakuhachi in a very traditional way.
That's correct. I did, in fact, grow up in Hawaii. Yeah. And right out of high school, before starting University, I had the opportunity to go to Japan. Mm-hmm. And once I was there, I happened upon the instrument. And long story short, I was going to be there once for 3 months, and I ended up staying for 7 years.
Because you got caught up in
it. I did indeed.
Usually when one learns an instrument, a traditional instrument in a very traditional way, it comes attached with all kinds of, I don't want to call them restrictions, but boundaries.
Yes.
This is what you're supposed to do with it.
Correct.
This is what it's supposed to be used for.
Yes.
It certainly wasn't learn to play this and then go out and get a bass player and drummer and start a band, right? It's meant to stay within certain confines originally.
I suppose you could say that, yes.
Well, because now, see, what I'm getting at, Riley, is I now see instruments where the tabla, you know, a South yes. Indian instrument is used in a jazz ensemble.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very useful in one because it's a drum that can
do things, yeah.
Play melodies. So why wouldn't you? But for centuries, it stayed within its borders, just as the shakuhachi did.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an accurate description?
That is true. And certainly of players of my generation, the idea that you have to have the foundation of that tradition you have to know that tradition. Otherwise,
yeah.
you don't really know the instrument. was a major part of our wanting to learn the tradition. In my case, that's the music I enjoy the best.
And that remains a very valid notion. But yes. What you've done with Island Breeze is you've merged with slack key guitar and taiko drums.
Yes.
They weren't originally intended.
No. And again, in my case, because I don't live in Japan, after the 7 years, first I came back to Hawaii and lived with my wife, and we had two kids here for a number of years. You know, you have to play what you can play. If you're going to make a living as a musician, you have to play with other musicians around you. It's very hard to
Amen.
Have. And you'd want to. And, of course, I did play with the traditional, and still do, Japanese instruments like the koto and the shamisen and so forth. But given the opportunity, I play with other fine musicians.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what they play in a sense. It's are they really good musicians? It's
sure.
not the instrument so much. Though, having said that, traditionally taiko, which is also a Japanese instrument, was not played with shakuhachi. In large part because shakuhachi is a very soft instrument.
You couldn't hear it.
No.
Yeah.
And this is a case in point where it's not so much the instruments, but it's the players. Kenny Endo, of all the taiko players I know, is one of the few that can play taiko with nuances, subtleties.
Yeah.
He can do everything with it. And then the other instrument with this group, again, is it's... I think slack key guitar works with shakuhachi. It doesn't matter who's doing either.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think Jeff and I, when we first started playing together, and that was, I don't know, 10 or 15
Jeff
years
Peterson.
Ago. Jeff Peterson. We just hit it off. And there's just something, you know, I don't know what it is. There's sometimes you just know.
Musicians know, right?
I can work with this guy. And it's one of these things where we're playing together, and I'm lost. I don't know where I am, right?
Uh-huh.
And there's some way, because I know Jeff, and he's playing along, and, you know, he just kind of, he's looking around, he's playing, he's looking at his guitar, and he just looks at me in a way that tells me where I'm supposed to be.
Uh-huh.
There's this communication.
There's a lot of performing with other musicians is on the level of ESP, don't you think?
Well, in this case, yes.
When it works, yes.
Yeah, it's just wonderful. With this, this is an ideal collaboration in my mind. I'm so lucky to be a part of it.
There's a very evocative quality to this instrument, and I'd like to ask you to just play a little bit of it to show what can be done with it.
Okay, I'm going to play a brief segment from a piece that we will play.
Terrific.
It's called Eagle in the Ocean, or Mano o Kikai.
All right.
And you're only going to hear a third of what it should be.
I'll be keeping a watch on the clock for you.
Okay. It's based on an Okinawan scale.
Uh-huh. Riley, I was watching to sort of try to figure out how you get to so many nuances of sound that you get from that instrument. One of them was a pitch variation by just shaking your head as you play a note, right?
That's right, yes. One has to do that because we don't have many finger holes.
Yeah.
We've only got four in the front, one in the back.
Piece of wood with five holes in it. It's amazing how much you also sort of half covered a hole to get some effects.
Correct, because, again, I can do that because there's no keys or pads. So the simplicity of the instrument requires more from the player, but on the other hand, it allows the player to do more as well.
Yeah, because you got also a kind of an octave harmonic jump, didn't you, just without changing anything with your fingering.
That's right, yes, yes. Yeah, no, it's a... Its simplicity is beguiling, and also it's
a little bit deceptive.
Deceptive, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Sounded great. It was great to hear that. Riley Lee was the first non-Japanese to attain the rank of Dai Shihan, our Grand Master, in shakuhachi, the instrument you just heard, the Japanese bamboo flute. His group Island Breeze features Riley, Jeff Peterson on slack key guitar, Kenny Endo on taiko drums. They'll be performing at 7 p.m. this Saturday at Shingonshu Hawaii Temple.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
And that brings to a close today's edition of the Conversation. Up tomorrow, Beth Ann Kozovich will sit down with the new Department of Education Superintendent Christina Kishimoto on Town Square. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for Town Square.